Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicview.com. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@theorganicview.com. Today's show is sponsored by RamVPN.com, the leading provider of next-generation online anonymity and VPN security solutions. Their architecture is unique, tamper-safe, and 100% guaranteed. They even accept Bitcoin. Listeners of the Organic View Radio Show can receive a 15% discount in 3-month and 6-month personal plans by using the coupon code ORGVIEW. That's ORGVIEW. For more promotional offers, please visit our website at www.theorganicview.com. Also, don't forget to check out our contest section on our website for your chance to win one of our cool prizes. For more information, please visit www.theorganicview.com/contest. As we continue our special series called The Neonicotinoid View, my special guest co-host Tom Theobald and I are going to talk to Mr. Rich Dengis, who is the water quality manager from the Southwest Regional Office, Department of Ecology for the State of Washington, in regards to a very hot topic concerning a permit that was issued to oyster farmers for a neonicotinoid called imidacloprid. Then later on, scientist Rich Andrews is going to join us to talk about the evolution of the term CCD, otherwise known as colony collapse disorder. But first, I'd like to welcome to the show Tom Theobald. Hello, Tom.
Hello, June. It's a beautiful spring day in the Rockies.
Always nice to get the weather report, Tom. They should really pay you extra.
Well, I lead an exciting life.
And I'd like to welcome to the show our first guest, Mr. Rich Dengis. Good afternoon, sir, and I hope I pronounced your last name correctly.
You did. I'm one of the few that can. Happy happy day after Earth Day from the green state of Washington.
Thank you, sir. Could you take a moment and tell our audience a little bit about yourself as well as what your area of responsibility is?
Sure. I'm employed here by the Washington State Department of Ecology, and I manage the water quality program in the southwest corner of the state. So in that office, we issue permits for a variety of purposes, commonly with wastewater treatment plants, but also for industries, stormwater permits, all designed to meet water quality standards that the state of Washington implements under delegated authority from the Environmental Protection Agency. In my particular background, I have a degree in natural resources and a master's degree in forest science. Been working here at the Department of Ecology for about just over a year, but have worked in a variety of different natural resource jobs, both domestically and overseas, and worked on stormwater management, and also in the agricultural community on farmland preservation.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today. This has been I can't tell you how explosive this whole topic has been. So many people have been commenting and writing and sending messages on social media. It's great that you could take the time to join us.
Now, my pleasure.
Thank you. Could you give us a little bit of the background for the permit?
Sure. In case your readers, I'd also recommend your readers take a look at our website, www.ecy.wa.gov, and just in the search box type in burrowing shrimp, and you get some of the background information. But briefly, the agency received a request from the Willapa Bay and Grays Harbor Oyster Growers Association. They wanted us to consider authorizing a permit for the use of imidacloprid for the control of two species of burrowing shrimp, ghost shrimp and mud shrimp. These are native shrimp that inhabit those two bays on the west coast of Washington State. And in high densities, these shrimp basically turn the substrate, the sediment, so soft that the oysters and clams suffocate. They actually, you know, sink into the sediment. And the growers have been using chemicals, pesticides, periodically to control these shrimp. The shrimp have cyclic populations. They've been using chemicals since the 1960s. They had an existing permit from the state of Department of Ecology to spray a pesticide known as carbaryl. They wanted to phase out of that, find something that, in their view, would be a little bit more benign environmentally, and in addition to exploring other cultivation methods to reduce impacts from these burrowing shrimp. So in the end, they had settled on imidacloprid. So after years of research, different trials, we reviewed information, just recently completed a environmental impact statement and had a review under the State Environmental Protection Protection Act, had a public comment period, and we, in the end, felt that we had enough information to issue a permit. In the five-year permit, every year there's monitoring efforts that take place, and monitoring in this area includes monitoring of the water column as well as the sediments. And the growers are authorized to apply imidacloprid at about a half a pound of active ingredient per acre. They can only treat and it's only for use on commercial shellfish beds in the tidelands of these two bays.
I'm just curious, what is the predator for these shrimp?
There are a number of natural predators of shrimp. It can be other fish. It can be other invertebrates, as well as I think some birds predate them as well. The information we had, though, is that the population of burrowing shrimp, like I mentioned, is kind of goes up and down. And we're just in a period right now where there's a population burst, if you will, of these particular critters, and it's very problematic and causing some serious economic harm to the shellfish growers. I don't know if your listeners are aware, but commercial shellfish is an important occupation in some parts of Washington State, and my understanding is that nearly a quarter of all the commercial or oysters produced in the U.S. come out of these two bays.
Thank you. In regards to the application, there's so many questions that I have, and I know we have a limited amount of time. Actually, I'd like to begin by asking you, was the species at risk of becoming annihilated in that particular region?
Are you talking about
the oysters? Because of the situation. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think what was occurring is that there were certain areas that growers could not use. Most of these in the state of Washington, the majority of tidelands are privately owned. So these are pieces of ground that are inundated when at high tide. They're dry at low tide. And for generations, they've been practicing shellfish cultivation out here. And what was happening is some areas, they could no longer farm, or that when they had shellfish, oysters growing and fattening, shrimp were coming in and destabilizing the sediment, and they were actually losing their crop, if you will.
Were there any concerns about the use of this particular chemical because it's so pervasive? The reason that I ask is because a few years ago there was a major lawsuit because imidacloprid was found in the drinking water on Long Island, and that's where I actually live, and it was a very, very big problem, especially for the residents here. Has there been any concern about the fact that this is going into open water?
It's unusual. It's a different application of imidacloprid than probably you and many of your listeners have heard about. And the registration that the growers received from EPA, it was very specific. It was specific only for commercial shellfish beds and only for Willapa Bay and Grace Harbor in Washington State. The concern about impacts to non-target species, the concern about persistence, that's something we did consider before we issued the permit. And one of the monitoring requirements we have is that there needs to be, and there will be done, some pretty intensive sediment monitoring of the benthic invertebrates. And what we're really looking for is to ensure that there's a recovery of the benthic invertebrates at least within 2 weeks after an application of imidacloprid. So we're going to closely look at the results of those studies. And as I mentioned before, it's a 5-year permit. There's no guarantee the permit would be renewed or reissued. So the monitoring results will be a factor as we consider what action we're going to take at the end of the permit term. Now, it's a little different being in a tidelands. There's no drinking water sources. This is in the marine water. So we're pretty confident that there's not going to be impact to any aquifer. And additionally, imidacloprid does degrade fairly quickly when it's exposed to light. There is good documentation to show that if it gets into the sediment, it'll tend to last longer. The difference, perhaps, between a tideland and a farm field or potato field that used to be out there in Long Island was that in the tidelands, the ground is impacted by tidal action, by actions of marine invertebrates, and there's an opportunity for any residual pesticide to get exposed to the ground, to the air, and to sunlight and degrade. But the potential for it to persist in the sediment is one reason why we require these monitoring studies to be completed.
Thank you. Another question that I have is, have they weighed the impact of imidacloprid on other species? There's been a significant amount of research that's been done by, for example, Dr. Hank Tenekes, who's proven the dose-time ratio. There's a scientist in Canada. Dr. Minot. There's so many different scientists that have done research on the impact of invertebrates and other species. So I'm just curious how much of that research was considered into this decision.
I think a lot. I think a lot of it was. There was a lot of information that EPA had considered when it prepared the registration for the pesticide. Part of the issue is that most of the studies took place in terrestrial environments. There were some in aquatic, but most of it was terrestrial, and that's a little different. Additionally, most of the invertebrates that were studied tended to be insects, obviously, and the response by crustaceans, mollusks, annelids, polychaetes in the marine environment, a little different. Imidacloprid is still effective, but it has a different mechanism there. But that was, to conclude, all that information was considered.
I have a question, if I could have a moment. June, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. Continue, Tom.
As I understand it, this would involve 1,500 acres in Willapa Bay and 500 acres in Grays Harbor. Now, the question that's been asked of me in the short period of time that people have been aware of this is, have you considered the fate of the chemicals that will be applied to this acreage as the tide moves in and out? You mentioned earlier that one of the advantages is this won't be administered to an aquifer, but the ocean is the largest aquifer we have, and obviously that's a question. Have you considered what the fate of these chemicals will be?
Yeah, the fate and transport after application, absolutely. And those are some of the tests and sampling that were taken before the permit was issued. And what we found is, again, the fate and transport of imidacloprid after application when the tide comes in, fairly limited. There's some rapid degradation, and we can really, within a couple hundred meters, get to a point of a non-detect. So that is a concern. We did look into it, and from the information we have at the time we issued the permit, we were persuaded that it wasn't going to be a significant impact.
Can you tell the listeners how a half pound per acre would compare with how it might be applied to farm ground, for example?
That's a good question. I do not know the answer to that. I don't know if it's related. I know obviously a lot of your viewers or listeners are familiar with the association with neonicotinoids and bee colony collapse. And at least what we understand from the work that US EPA did in 2013 during the registration is that the concentration of half a pound per acre would be below concentrations that would impact honeybees. I'm not an expert in that, but that's my understanding of what EPA has determined.
Thank you.
Were there any other chemicals that were considered besides imidacloprid?
When we conducted the environmental impact, the other chemical that was considered was carbaryl. That was the pesticide that's been currently in use, and so that was one of the alternatives considered.
Thank you. At this particular point, I would just like to thank you for taking the time out of your schedule. I know that this has been a topic that has flooded your office with a lot of calls, but I really do appreciate your time and for explaining the position of your department as far as why they decided to move forward and issue this permit.
Yes, thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity. And, if you have a need for additional questions, please follow up.
Thank you. I certainly will. Now joining us is scientist Rich Andrews, who is going to talk to us about colony collapse disorder, otherwise known as CCD. Lately, there have been a number of discussions about this subject, and there's still a great deal of confusion as to exactly what the term means. So I'd like to welcome to the show Rich Andrews. Good afternoon, Rich, and thanks for joining us.
Hello. Yes, I appreciate being on. I really thought I was probably going to chime in a little more on this bay oyster and burrowing shrimp question. In fact,
sure.
Do you have some
like,
things you'd like to add?
Sure, by all means.
Well, I guess I'm wondering is Rich the other Rich on the line still?
No, he had a limited amount of time.
Okay.
So, but by all means, please.
Okay. Well, I guess there was a number of things that really just jump out at me about the use of pesticides in open waters, which are considered waters of the state and waters of the United States. And in fact, how can one legally even issue a permit to pollute these waters under the Clean Water Act of the United States, let alone the Companion Act within the state of Washington? It just does not compute to me to be sensible or legal. I just had to say that.
You used to work for the EPA. Correct?
I did, and I worked in the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Enforcement Activity, which is the very kind of permit that this is. I authored a lot of permits myself. Another thing that in reading and studying up on what's going on in Washington on this, the other Rich mentions the permit for carbaryl, which in my reading of the information off of the State of Washington's Department of Ecology website, that permit is still legitimate. So, in fact, oyster producers can, in fact, use both carbaryl and imidacloprid and still not be violating anything. There really is something that's been silent and hasn't really been discussed, that they can use both in my reading of these permits, because the one was not rescinded when the new one was issued.
I read somewhere, though, Rich, that there was an agreement to cease using the carbaryl, and that the
That's
true. Department of Ecology actually violated that in the year after the agreement by allowing Carbaryl to continue to be used.
But there's nothing
that
rescinds it.
What other chemicals they compared?
Well, I maybe that's just a minor point here at this moment, but you know, I'm sorry the other Rich isn't on the line. I would have asked him that directly. The other thing is that the allowable concentrations that they refer to in their environmental impact statement in doing you know, the assessment as to whether or not this permit could be issued are allowing concentrations much higher than the concentrations that have been established, let's say, in Holland or the Netherlands, on what's acceptable with in water for protection of invertebrate species. The risk assessment done by the state of Washington allows between off bed water concentrations, meaning outside of the treated bed area, ranging from 0.35 micrograms per liter up to 4,200 micrograms per liter. Well, you know, the more protective standards that are really based upon a lot of invertebrate studies done in Holland in particular, their standards are short-term maximum acceptables of 0.2 micrograms per liter, which is lower than this for sure, and the maximum kind of a long-term expected concentrations are 0.008 micrograms per liter. We're down into the 8 parts per trillion range, in other words, much, much lower, that have, you know, chronic effects and chronic toxicities, and not just looking at acute. So
there has been research that has shown that as little as 1 part per trillion can have a long-term effect on the honeybee, and there's no reason to believe that those very small amounts wouldn't have similar effects on other fundamental life forms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and reading the permit itself, the one that was issued to the Willapa Bay, Willapa Grays Harbor Oyster Growers Association, you know, it writes right into it that the state acknowledges that it is violating their own standards. And that just seems plain weird to me. I also would like to raise another point, and that is, what about all of the monitoring that is being required on this? There is actually no monitoring of the harvested species themselves, the clams and the oysters. They're only looking at the other things and sediment concentrations and water concentrations. But they're not saying, what about what they're actually harvesting and they're feeding to people that are buying these oysters? And I find that as a serious, serious issue of, doesn't make me want to go out and eat oysters, that's for sure.
Well, on another note, I guess the question that keeps jumping out at me is they're applying imidacloprid to protect these oysters because basically they're suffocating, which is understandable. They want to protect this species. But the impact of imidacloprid on the other species is, it basically begs the question, okay, do we protect one species and kill how many other, or poison how many other species? And the thing is that it is a tough decision that they're making, but at the end of the day, are they doing more harm than good? And that remains to be seen. But in regards to the next topic, which is the never-ending saga surrounding the whole term colony collapse disorder, it's interesting when you take a look at some of the discussions that are going on throughout social media or even discussions amongst beekeepers, different news groups, blogs, what have you, how convoluted this term is. Tom, can you share with our listeners exactly how the term colony collapse disorder came about and, in your opinion, what this term actually means.
It has an interesting history, and unfortunately I've been involved in this whole issue long enough that I've seen it unfold. When we first began to recognize the problems that we were having, we tried to use some kind of shorthand so that we could communicate with each other to describe what we saw, and we came to the term colony collapse, because one of the most visible symptoms was a sudden depopulation of a colony, what appeared to be a sudden disappearance. And what was interesting, if you were reading between the lines and watching what was going on, that was quickly captured by the chemical industry and turned into colony collapse disorder. And it was a very subtle and effective diversionary tactic to focus attention on this supposed mysterious, complicated, difficult to understand disorder that was going to require years of research and millions of dollars. And of course it appealed to scientists because it was funding for research on this mysterious malady. It was also referred to as a malady. So colony collapse happens. It certainly does, and any beekeeper would tell you that, and most of us have experienced it far too often. But it's only one of many, many symptoms of poisoning by the family of neonicotinoids.
Rich, would you care to elaborate about how you've seen the term evolve?
Well, I think the term, like a lot of buzzwords, it's probably been misused a lot. And the other kind of aspect of all of this is, the one-liners that come out of the pesticide bias side of all of this discussion are always saying, well, you know, it's because of diseases that we see. It's not because of pesticides. It's because of mites or viral infections or all sorts of, habitat and food quality problems and that sort of thing. And that has all been wrapped into this whole discussion that kind of gets generally carried under the topic of CCD. I guess I would personally like to see the CCD descriptor disappear from the jargon, because we really need to be talking about what the bees and other pollinators are suffering from, really. And I think at least Tom and I know for sure that in looking at all of the science that we see that comes out, you know, almost every other day, there's a paper, a scientific paper, and, you know, 95% of those papers are implicating pesticides as the triggering cause of the decline of the pollinators. And they cause that decline in a lot of different ways. They cause it by destroying the natural defense mechanisms of these insects, these important beneficial insects. They make them more vulnerable to some of these other things that the pesticide industry likes to say are the real problem, like the varroa mite or Nosema or some of these other issues. Those things, those are present, but the bees can normally fight those things off in a healthy colony. So really what has changed over the last 10, 15 years has been the presence and the rise of these pesticides, the massive prevalence of their use worldwide.
One of the interesting background stories to this issue, many of the things that Rich has described as symptoms would be denied by the manufacturers, Bayer primarily, and yet if you look at what they promote as termite control, They advertise that as effective on the basis of exactly the same things that we're concerned about in the bee population, in the wild pollinator population, in many other populations at the lower end of the food chain. They don't feel bound by the truth if it serves their interests, unfortunately.
I made a comment earlier today
that the
spin factor is getting so extreme that I predicted the days will be shortening on the Earth because the Earth is spinning so much faster.
Yep.
Well, it's just interesting that the term is constantly used, but yet the application of neonicotinoids in agriculture or even in the home environment is not necessarily part of that equation. If you think about other areas in life, for example, with building your core, say in fitness, most personal trainers will tell you if you have a strong core, then you'll be able to have a strong back, strong arms, legs, what have you. And it's the same principle. If the immune system of the honeybee or any animal for that matter has been weakened, of course they're going to succumb to different illnesses. What are your thoughts, Tom?
Well, they have, and that's exactly what we've been seeing. We've been seeing a multitude of symptoms, and experienced beekeepers who work with hundreds, perhaps thousands of colonies have an immediate impression of what's going on, and we, those of us who have been around for a while, understand what it should be like. Many of the newer beekeepers lack a context in which to compare what they're seeing. They don't know what a thriving colony of bees should look like many times, and we're seeing all sorts of both dramatic and subtle consequences. A colony of bees is a very resilient but yet very delicately balanced superorganism, and much of that balance, much of the timing and the interaction of that superorganism is regulated by chemical signals, by pheromones and scents and things like that. And one of our concerns, and research is beginning to confirm it, is that this neurological damage that's incurred at even the tiniest doses of these neonicotinoids is disrupting that delicate balance. And the colony, collectively and individually, doesn't know what to do. We're seeing, for example, swarms, which are a natural way that a colony would divide and multiply and would normally occur in the spring. We're seeing those kinds of swarms far into the summer and even into the fall. We're seeing queen replacements and queen failures on a regular basis. We're seeing queens that appear to be doing well, but to the bees, they believe something is going wrong, and they'll kill that queen and replace her. It's a terrible disruption of the beekeeping superorganism.
So, Tom, should the term colony collapse continue to be used in discussions when it comes to issues with the bees?
Well, I think colony collapse should continue to be used with the understanding of what it is. What the chemical industry would like everybody to believe is it's this great, complex, unsolved mystery, and it's going to take years to unravel it. There's no mystery here. We know exactly what's going on, and we have an industry and regulators who invest their time and energy and talent in looking for excuses for what they're doing. And we'll see the same thing with this oyster issue. They'll look for excuses for the continued use of this chemical. One of the things they're trying to do is they're trying to slip a letter bomb under the door, and that letter bomb is trying to include the neonicotinoids under the concept of integrated pest management.
And that's been going on for
ridiculous.
That's been going on for quite a number. I would say about a year now.
At least a year that I've been aware of. Yes.
Because I know we've talked about that in the past, But I think Rich Andrews made an excellent point, which is what is going to be the control as far as for people that are going to be consuming these oysters? You know, are they going to be testing the oysters? Are they going to be testing any effects with humans? I mean, it's something that remains to be seen, but you know, it once again is an excellent point. So thank you, Rich.
And, yeah, there's an increasing amount of technical medical journal writing that's occurring that shows that these many if not all of the neonicotinoids in fact have severe harmful medical effects on us mammals. And so I think that's a extremely important piece of research that needs to be ramped up, and the regulatory agencies need to pay attention to it, which they don't. And
Be curious to see what Christy Marcy from Tom, where is she from? Ontario?
What was the name again?
Christy Marcy.
Oh, Christy is from Maine.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'd be interested to see what she has to say, as well as Pierre Minot, as far as what their opinion is on the approval for this particular permit. But, you know, once again, it remains to be seen.
I have one more question back to the oyster issue. I was talking with a leading commercial beekeeper on this very subject earlier today. And the question relates to the authority to regulate pesticides, and it's our understanding that that rests primarily with the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and that authority can be delegated to a state agency, usually a Department of Agriculture or something like the Department of Ecology or something like that, and that's called the primacy partner. Now, the primacy partner, the state primacy partner, can pass pesticide regulations that are equal to or more strict than the federal regulations, but not more lenient. And the question that was raised during the course of that discussion is, isn't this provision for the use of imidacloprid in the fashion that it's being used a violation of federal law, a diminishment of the federal regulations, and is it being instigated by the chemical industry to establish a precedent that would be a violation of FIFRA, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act?
That's an excellent point, Tom. Well, the information is available on their website, which is www.ecy.wa.gov, and you're going to have to search for the actual document. It's a pretty long URL, but folks, this particular document, as well as the other information from this particular department, will be available in the article that follows this particular interview. I'm just trying to see what other information is available on their website. There's a lot of information, actually, about this whole decision. The comment section was included with the documentation. They really put a lot of information out there, which is nice. Normally, we haven't been finding that all the information has been readily available and easily accessible, should I add. So, you know, once again, there is a lot of information that pertains to this permit. And as Rich Andrews just said, it remains to be seen as far as what's going to happen as far as the human health impact, as well as other species that are going to be affected by this. So, you know, we have to give them an opportunity to do what they're doing, and then we can revisit this at another point in time. Rich, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show today and for your contribution to the conversation. It's always great to hear from you.
Thank you.
And Tom, thank you also for the weather report and for
you're welcome.
Chiming in. And folks, thank you for tuning in. This has been June Sawyer with the Organic View Radio Show. tune in each week as Tom and I continue to explore the impact of neonicotinoids. Have a great afternoon, everyone.
Thank you, Rich.
Yep.
Thank you, Tom.